cases, they used several words in brackets, the better to be understood. After a long beginning in praise of Janice and the company, the problem was brought forth. It was done as Hearing liked it, weighed up with words, intricate, indirect, and important with punctuation marks. When they finally mailed it, Janice felt a pulse or two of the power that words can bring. They had now a matter spoken of in writing, official as law, urgent. The man would look to his mill. But weeks went by and no word came back to them. Then, at last, a mysterious printed note appeared on her table. It said that her communication had been received and contents duly noted, and that appropriate action would be taken at the earliest possible opportunity. They spent 3 evenings making this meaning plain. During the next inspection, the vice presidents and section heads and secretaries paused to smile into the bare cubicle where Janice sat waiting, and when they had gone, she went after them and managed to get one of the following lesser ones who wouldn't be missed to stop and write for her what had been said. "Our backup girl," the note said. "We have to have a backup girl. This worker has been with us for a long time." She thought she had lip-read something like "pack up and go," but perhaps it had been backup girl after all. And then, too, there had been the smiling. She went home with the note. Abel could not find backup in the dictionary. Hearing played games, and she was trying to play them as well as Abel, but Hearing have no meaning to their lives, no need for meaning. Under this backup, there was a lie. She felt it in the smiling somewhere. It was a lie. And how clever they were, lifting and locking and lying and dropping the secret again, fingers to lips, to take it up again without her knowing. There was nothing to do but smile back at them and nod, yes, yes, and stop caring about them. One evening, Abel put down his paper and began to do some figuring with a pencil. Janice watched him from the kitchen. He was sitting at the table, and when he finished, he looked up into the mirror on the other wall, staring at it, and then shaking his head. It wasn't long since the death of Abel's father. Abel went alone to the funeral and to help his mother move into a small house in the town. Since then, Janice sometimes came upon him staring at the wall or his dinner plate, thinking of some other place and time. She sighed and came in from the kitchen, drying her hands on her apron. She saw that he was staring at her, not at her directly, but into the mirror, at the person who was there. It made her angry for some reason, so she said through the mirror, "What is it?" quickly, in annoyance. He looked away from the image and came back to her. "Next month is our anniversary." "So?" "We will be married 40 years then." "That can't be." "Yes, I figured it out." Words might lie, but numbers never. A decade of piecework had ground the numbers deep. She went over to his paper and figured the dates. Then they both stood for a long time and peered unbelievingly into the mirror. Janice had written carefully, "What is backup girl?" Marshall took the paper, thought, looked again, thought again. Then he wrote, "It could be different things. It depends on how they meant it." The more he tried to explain, the more involved and fantastic it seemed. Because it was Marshall, Janice allowed herself only a flash of suspicion that he was hiding something, that it was one of Hearing's eternal game jokes to mean and not to mean, by which the deaf were always asked to pay the highest price and to wait the longest. In the end, Janice and Abel let themselves be reassured by him that it meant no insult or danger, and wasn't a bad thing to be called. With this worry out of the way, they began to plan their yearly trip to the circus. Marshall, now almost 15, had gotten too old to enjoy it as he once did, but he was afraid of hurting them. In the last few years, he had lost the ways of telling them any of the subtle things. All of his signs were gone long ago, and lately, he couldn't even read what they spelled to him on their fingers. When he had anything special to say, he used writing, but he depended more on their reading of his moods. Today he seemed worried, no, annoyed, as he tried to explain things to them, and then he wrote, I'm supposed to keep this secret, but Ma and Pa have plans to get something for you. It was hard for them to take seriously what he had written. Writing was and was not what it seemed to be, but because it was something that was making him unhappy, they told him they would speak to his parents about it. He shook his head violently and told them not to think about it anymore. It was supposed to be a TV set. Margaret had been saving to get a set as an anniversary present for Janice and Abel. William hadn't seen any sense in it. What was the point of watching TV when there couldn't be any sound? She only nodded in her quiet, accepting way and kept on saving until William told her it was ridiculous. $2 a week? He would get the set. If nothing else, her parents could watch the cigarette boxes dancing and the puppets. Wrestling and roller derbies needed no speech, and charades were often lettered out for the audiences to read. The firm had had a good year. Stop saving the household money. Start buying ribs and steaks again. I'll get the set. Margaret studied the buying of the set. She attacked it. She conquered it the way she did everything else, by wearing it down, by outliving it. She seemed to think of nothing but the TV set, and Marshall hated it. Every night his mother came home from another store with another report on another model to be worried over and compared. He didn't want a set in the grandparents' house. He wasn't sure why. He watched TV whenever he could at home and argued for his choices with the other kids. But he had a vague feeling that the old people would be changed, betrayed in some way by so much contact with the rude, cheap, bright part of the world. It made him uncomfortable to think of them side by side on the couch, staring at the box flickering white-gray in the darkened room. There were people in the world, certain people who were separated, like priests and nuns and cripples and midgets. They were holy people. They were very special in the world. The deaf were like that, special, separated, like holy people. He hated to think of them looking at TV. When his mother was finally ready with her plan, he made one of his own. She was going to have the men install the set while Janice and Abel were at work. Then the whole family would go over in the evening with a cake. Marshall decided that he wouldn't be there. Maybe he could get Rob Jefferson to ask him over for the night. He didn't want the old people to have him there, watching their shame and embarrassment because of that gift of his mother's. He didn't want to see them stumble over their honesty and their holiness as they thanked his father. Sometimes he barely felt himself his mother's child. She was always so busy fussing over the surfaces of things. She had no time to think what life should be like. Janice knew that the people at the mill wanted her to go. Somehow she knew that the manager would not come down and point her away. Instead, they had taken her up, unsuspecting, high above the safe places of work that could be seen and measured. And now they would wait until she did a wrong thing or complained or died of the height, the cold, and the loneliness. She was afraid to be absent too much from the useless, workless quality control office, lest there be a note there or a final slip in her pay envelope. All the war, she cried out night after night. Abel looked up to catch a word or two, then turned again to his food. All the war, E on the flag outside, and thanks from all the government and the army. You're still quick, still good. Why don't you ask to go back to the machines? It's all right if we don't have so much money. You never listen to me. They don't do the pieces anymore on the machines. When they changed the factory, they took out all the old machines and put in new ones, and the work goes from girl to girl. One does one flat seam, and another one turns the work, and it goes on, and other girls overseam. If a person is too fast, it's bad because it breaks the running of the line. I went in there and saw. The cloth goes by them and comes out hemmed, and that hides where they didn't back over. I don't know anything about fixing those machines, and they know it. Anyway, they don't let anyone fix those machines. They have a scientific man, so much it took him 3 different colleges, and you wait for the machine to break and then he comes and fixes it. Abel had heard it all before, but now he knew why it annoyed him to have her begin the whole thing again every night. It was because he couldn't help her. The changes were happening slowly in his own trade, too. Machines that eased the work and put out more of it. Each new machine was a blessing, but only last year he had noticed that there were fewer men in the shop, and some were there who did barely any work at all. The machines worked. There was no help for this, and no way he could comfort her. He shook his head and waved a bit with his left hand as though to interrupt himself and not her. "Go and finish the dishes, and I'll play you a game of checkers after." "For what?" she said, taking him up as though she had not just been sorrowing over the ending of her life. 25 moves, $1. She rushed to get ready. He had discovered that gambler streak in her. She played with the silent bridge group over at the church one night a week, but could barely stand the other players, she said, who were afraid of every bid and wouldn't risk a nickel unless they had all the cards. She had, because of this, invented a new idea. New, at least for the deaf community. The side bet. It was lucky he sometimes thought that they were not rich. The very, very small amounts won and lost enabled Janice to play with mad abandon, and he had given in to betting in their checker games the number of moves it would take him to win. Until she had discovered this risk, she had waved away the silent bridge, silent bingo, and canasta nights as childish and a waste of time. Now she could spend hours crouched over a card table or checkerboard of an evening if a quarter or 50 cents was at stake. He used the gambling sometimes to jolly her out of a bad mood, making absurd boasts that she couldn't resist. Shaking his head, he got up and began to get the board and set up the pieces. Janice came in to finish clearing the table.
"You need to play with Marshall again," Abel said. "He is getting better all the time."
It made her smile. Any mention of Marshall's name lightened her. They only used an initial for him, with a special little flip of the hand after it as though the hand would say, "beautiful," very quickly. Margaret's name was a stiff M, a correct M, and nothing bloomed near it.
"You remember that college when we went to visit Margaret William?"
The MW of their joint names was formal and austere, like the monograms Mrs. Anglin had put on the bathroom towels they had seen in Margaret's house. Did hearing forget their own names that they had to be so reminded?
"I remember the college," Janice said. "Marshall should go to college, too. It was a nice place where we were, where the students were walking under the trees."
"He should go to the best college," Abel said.
"A college is the same as the other colleges, isn't it?"
"Oh, no. Remember what Mr. Durov said about choosing the right college for his son?"
"Heaven won't be good enough for that family. They are so stuck up."
"He is smart, Mr. Durov. He spent a year at Gallaudet, and his father..."
"He never forgets about that year at Gallaudet either, or about his father. Marcella told me she heard they threw him out, and his father died after that just because he was disgusted."
Abel shook his head and waved her away, but he was laughing all the same. "Never mind about Marshall. Marshall won't go to Gallaudet. He can go to some big college, any famous and great one."
"You know," she said, "sometimes I dream that he does go to Gallaudet. In that dream, I see him signing so beautifully, and he always comes back here afterward and speaks in the church, and everybody gets so wise they are never afraid again. And they know how to do all the things, and the law and the court can never come against them."
He had finished setting up the checkers. "It's a stupid dream," he said. "Why should Marshall waste his time teaching a bunch of deafies?"
During the Second World War, the factories had invented something called sick leave. Janice had never used it because of fear and pride, and during the war she had heaped silent scorn on any of her floor girls who helped Hitler by staying out sick. After the war, she had wanted to keep up her record, but now, slowly and with the delicacy of a thread testing through the needle's eye, she began to sick leave. She began with a careful note left in the afternoon, a pained face coming late in the morning. Then the next month there was a whole day out, then two. In the winter she had 3 days then, late in the spring, three together. She had always had pains, headaches, and backaches, and wondered some mornings if she could drag to work. She had always made it, feeling barely fit to move, and somehow in the course of the day the flow of the cloth would take the pain away with it, and by evening it would be forgotten with the memory of the first cap or jacket or the first empty bobbin.
Now she indulged the pains and humored them, and so they remembered her. One Monday, a gang of painters came and began to paint the second-floor halls and workrooms, and the fumes of the paint had made her head pound. After lunch, she left a short note and started home. This absence was really the company's fault. Surely the smell would be no better tomorrow. She decided to stay out until Wednesday and see how her head felt. When she got out on the street, her headache cleared immediately, and a kind of tricking gladness made her feel light and irresponsible. She took the bus home. As it passed the streets of beautiful and interesting stores, she had a sudden desire to get off and look in all of the windows. But habit carried her on, and she sat back and stared out the window. A warm May rain had fallen and stopped. The streets breathed a little fog around the ankles of the shoppers and the wheels of the cars and trucks. The bus was warm, smelling of the wetness of coats and wool and people. Outside the bus, she was kept from it only by a window. The world had become clearer. All the colors she saw in the windows, the stoplights and store signs, the people walking, seemed to be richer, the lines and planes sharper and more distinct, as though without the sun, the day itself was glowing. There was an excitement about coming home at an odd time. Now the bus was almost empty, and instead of the tired, pushing rush hour people, there were only some placid shoppers, a few students coming from their morning classes and the patient salesman, shining at the elbows and giving up their weight to the seats with a relief that made the others smile. Then the bus turned off the crowded avenue, and it was time to get up. Janice waited for her stop near the door by habit. She had a fear of being caught in the doors, and when they opened at her stop, she always dashed down the step and out as though she were on fire. When the bus was full and there were people to push past, it was much worse. But this time at her stop, she was able to step down and leave the bus almost gracefully. The three-block walk was full of new sights. Small children were out riding tricycles, and a few people were weeding or thinning plants since the soil had been loosened by the rain. Usually when she came home, people were inside. Sometimes other workers would hurry along past her and turn up this walk or that, but now she stopped and stopped again, fascinated by the different signs and small activities going on around the houses and on the walkways. The mailman passed her and nodded. A car pulled up to him and stopped, and a woman's head poked out of the window. After a minute, Janice saw him pointing back in the direction the car had come. She went on. When she was in sight of her own house, she quickened a little by habit and then stopped. It was not a trick of the light. She moved forward and stopped again. The door of her house was open. The front door was open. Her heart began to pound. Then a man came out. He walked as easily and naturally as though the house were his own. Then she noticed that there was a truck parked at the curb, a blue-green color, not large. She was trembling. She tried to stop by clenching her teeth, but the fear came and grew inside her, bursting in the trembling and then beginning again. The man went to the truck and opened the back. He was a long time there where she could not see what he was doing. If she could know how long he would stay, she might run around to the back of the house and inside through the back door, and she would get the ice pick and the big bread knife. Another man came out of the doorway and seemed to be calling something. The truck back one was bringing some kind of building thing up the walk. When he got close to the house, he put it down and began to work with it on the lawn. She saw. Too late. It was a kind of ladder. The man did not go into the house. Instead, he started to climb the ladder that he had put together. He was on the roof when she turned and ran. At the corner lived Mrs. Nibbling, who had helped Janice once during very bad weather. She ran up the walk and pounded on the door. Nothing happened. She pounded until her hands were sore, and then she ran around the corner and saw a man working in the yard. She would be clear, clear, and she tried with her voice to get the man to understand.
Bolit, man! Gau bolit! Gau bolit!
The man rose, looked at her, going gabble-baggle with his mouth, which she was too anguished to read. She tried putting her head back and crying, "Help!" But when she looked again, the man had left the garden, tools and all, and gone into the house, and there was the door going closed behind him. Then she remembered her purse. There were writing things in it for times when she had wanted to say, "Have you got it in green, size 34, to someone. She wrote, "I am deaf. Rob's house. Call police." Garden man wouldn't open the door. She ran on, crying in dry sobs, her hair flying from the restrain pins, her mouth forming over and over as the school had taught, "Call police! Call police!" There was a cramp forming in her stomach and a dry stitch in her side. At last, there was someone, a man. He was moving toward her slowly, an older man, out for a walk. She ran up to him and showed him, and he read, following word, word, word with his finger, and she nodded and nodded at each word. "It is true. Hear it. Please hear it. Bolit, yes, yes," forming the pictures of the sounds with her lips as she had been taught. The man nodded and turned in at a house, gesturing to her. "Follow." When they reached the door, there was the knocking and waiting and ram-gabble, ram-gabble, while the criminals tore and harried black visions in her mind. All the furniture was going, piece by piece, into that truck. All the careful years and years. She wanted to beat the walls, to slam and beat at everything. The man and the woman had decided to use the telephone. The man was picking it up, and as he spoke into it, the woman stood back away from her, measuring with a moon-dead stare. After the man spoke for a little while, he closed the phone and they motioned for her to sit down. The waiting was almost worse than the running. She had no idea of what the man had said or even if he had understood her. Perhaps they had called up the crazy house men to come and take her away to be a madwoman. As they waited, a few words went between the man and the woman. The woman seemed to be offering coffee. Janice began to practice think the words she wanted to say. "Sorry trouble you," to the people. "And iao kom nao mao u," to the police. She thought the words over and formed them, going very carefully in her mind. And then she realized that her face had been moving with them and the people were staring, appalled at her. And so she stopped and put her head down for the time to wash over, and they waited. The police came and the words fled. She could only nod to the people and pull the policeman along by the hand as an angry mother pulls a willful child. She dared not get into the car with them lest they take her to the jail, so she and one dazed officer pulled and struggled around the corner and up the block, while the squad car followed them with its magical, inexorable dignity. The criminals were still there. The ladder was still against the house, the truck still at the curb. As Janice and the policeman came up, the front door opened again and one of the men came out. Her policeman, breathless and red-faced, disengaged himself and went forward to speak to the man. The car stopped and the other patrolman got out. They went to the house and then to the truck and back to the house again. Janice stood and waited, trembling from time to time, ready to run or, if shot, to fall. Then someone else appeared at the door. And Janice looked, and then looked again. Margaret. It was Margaret there. They stood looking at each other, no words forming in the hands or in the mind. They stood that way for a long minute, and then Margaret very slowly raised her hands and said, "Your anniversary. We got you a TV. Look around now." Janice saw that all around her were doors and windows. There were 100 doors and 100 windows, and all the doors and windows were full of the heads of people, looking. Could there be so many people home, all home in the middle of the day? Some had come out onto their walks to see better, standing with heads half planted in curlers, some clutching dust rags or wet-handed from the dishes. And knee-length at their pastel pants were a band of the wide, wounded stares of children. All the eyes moved with her as she went the miles from the corner of the lot to the front walk, and up the walk to the steps, and up the steps to the porch, and across the porch to the doorway. The doorway was empty. Margaret had shaken her head and gone to wait out her shame alone.
20. The doctor assured them that it had been a very small attack. But when Abel had recovered and was able to go out, he went to his friends and asked all of them if they had had such sicknesses and what their doctors had said. Since he had never been sick before, the functions and failings of the body had been of no particular interest to him. Janice had always been the sick one, and now he shared with her the hypnotic round of symptoms and signals and doctor's offices. Sometimes he thought that the attack had saved Janice from a terrible sickness of the mind. For a week after the strange day, she had done nothing but sit in the house and stare out of the window. He had never thought of her growing old. She had been old nearly 40 years ago. He had never imagined her changing any more than she had changed in the first bitter seasons of their debt. The strange day had been meant to be called the happy day or the proud day, but there had been part of it that had gone on after happy and good, so that whenever he remembered it, he could not tell where the good had ended and the strange began. It had started with a letter addressed to him from an office at Janice's factory. It was called Public Relations Office, and it asked if the man might come to see him at work. The man had come and brought another man with him from the deaf school to interpret. Janice, they told him, had been working for 45 years. She had been longer at the factory than anyone else, even the president, who had retired 5 years ago and given control to a son. Loyalty like that was very rare these days, they told him, and must be rewarded. They wanted to have a big party in which she would be guest of honor. She would be given many gifts and would sit next to the president at the luncheon and have her picture taken with him and with the old president, and there would be speeches and champagne. Abel had looked blankly back at them. What do I have to do? They told him that he would have to do nothing but keep the secret and be sure she came on the day of the party with him. She must not come in the morning but at noon, and he must try to get off work and come and be with her. He would have a seat at the head table also. Were there any pictures of her when she was younger, when she had started work? Were there any funny or interesting stories that the family remembered about those early days? Were there children or grandchildren who might wish to be present? The man left a card and told Abel to write down the things as he thought of them and send them to the address that was on it. The party should be on the very day that Janice had started to work, and that was only 2 weeks away. It left them very little time to work to get everything planned. Then the man left, and Abel stood and looked at the card in his hand. Had it not been for Margaret, he couldn't have done it at all. She had remembered where some of the old pictures were. He had forgotten that in that single ancient summer of the car and the clothes and the food and the dappled sunshine, Janice and he had also posed for photographs. There was Janice, standing in front of a backdrop at the state fair. The dress of which she had been so proud had changed by magic, and now it had a misfitting, drooping look, and the shoes were wrong. Under the too large straw hat half hidden was that incomparable face whose smile cut him so that he had to look away from it. He had handed it back to Margaret. "This is the right picture." Margaret looked at it, and he thought her expression had wonder in it. "Let's get one of both of you," she said. He protested, but she was already turning through the small pile. "Here." The car. He had forgotten who had taken it or when, but there they stood, preening and squinting beside it with pathetic pride, their clothes ridiculous, their faces too handsome and empty to be real. The picture made him ashamed somehow, and Margaret laughed at him until he gave it back to her. For 2 days they met downtown for lunch and combed their minds for stories that would interest and amuse. "Bradley was the funny one. He was always getting into trouble," Abel said. "Remember when we went to pick up the week's pieces once and we got everything loaded and we left the mill and we forgot Bradley there and we walked 2 blocks without him?" Margaret shook her head. "I don't think it would be right to tell a story about Bradley. People would ask where he was. It would make them uncomfortable." "Remember when the union people were against us and we kept trying to find ways of getting the pieces out?"
"I don't think they would want that to be remembered."
"But about how they said we were taking bread out of their children's mouths, and we thought..."
"I don't think they would want to hear about those things." You could tell about the thread. Once, I think it was soon after she started the pieces at home, once they gave her the wrong color thread. The pieces were dark blue for work clothes, you know, and the thread they gave her was pink. She got so scared she didn't know what to do, so I took the thread to work and dipped it in the printing ink. There were 7 or 8 spools of it, and the ink is very greasy. So then we had to dry all the thread out. We dried it out in the oven, and then we put it in hot water to get the grease out and dried it again. It came out black, but every time a person rubbed his hand on it, it was sooty, and the color came off on his hand. She did all the pieces, and when we took them back, the people were counting them, and your mother just stood there with her eyes closed until they were all finished, because she was so afraid someone would run his hand over one of the seams and have it come off black.
We can't tell that story either. It sounds so... it's so desperate.
Then you think of one.
I can't. I don't remember any good times there.
We had, he said, and was angry. Many times. You never knew cold or hunger or studied the money in your hand for a meal.
She seemed on the edge of an answer, but thought better of it and pursed her mouth and dropped her hands in her lap. She looked so neat and cold sitting before him. Her outfits always reminded Abel of Mrs. Anglin's. Everything matched. Everything was too carefully made to match. It gave her a false, glazed look. Her hair, which was a fine shade of brown, was still rich and thick, but it had been styled in a hard, elaborate way so that it looked glued in its mass, and no strand or single hair escaped that mass to give witness to her humanity. He knew that she disliked to sign in public and usually refused. He had asked her to come early and had taken time off to be at the restaurant and get the booth farthest back and to the left. No one would be able to see them signing. Even then, she hesitated, using a sign that was barely differentiated from casual gesture. She had come in precisely on time and had walked back to the booths, and his first sight of her was the same as it had been for years. A mixture of pride and sadness. She was such a straight, handsome, dignified woman, so smart, tight, and invulnerable. They are trying to honor your mother. They only want some little thing, he said. I know that. I was trying to think of something.
How is Marshall?
Fine. He likes college, but we miss him.
Do you think he will be able to come in for the party?
I've written to him about it, but I don't know. Of course, the other children are anxious to come.
Mention of the other children always made Abel a little uncomfortable. I know they are, he said vaguely. He had never been close to the others. And now, with Marshall gone, he regretted that he and Janice had been Marshall's allies against them, all of them, when they were born. The happy day was like a shining banner alive in the wind. Margaret, with her usual frightening cleverness, had worked Janice around to visiting a beauty parlor and had briefed Abel on the strategies of delay that would keep her from going to work in the morning. Abel feigned sickness, and at 11:30 feigned sleep. At 11:45, Margaret and the children came by, demanded that Janice change into her good dress and go out to the park with them to take pictures. Abel, suddenly recovered, was persuaded to join them. Once in the car, Margaret remembered that they had forgotten the camera, and that since Abel was now well, they would be able to take Janice to work. The children began to demand to see the place where Grandma worked. Janice's objections were not answered, and the car kept on. She began to plead with Abel. She had stayed out to nurse him, and yet now she was coming in, all dressed up. He only turned away. Margaret was busy driving, and Abel's eyes were on the road. The children did not sign. In the back seat beside Janice, the youngest one was giggling. Instead of parking on the side street, Margaret drove the car right up to the main gate, turned in, and went right into the plant grounds. There was one other car there, and they pulled in behind it, right at the main door of the plant. Janice was arguing unnoticed in the back seat.
They'll take the car away. Nobody is allowed to put cars here. Maybe they will call the police. I don't feel like working today. Let's come again some other time. I want to go home now.
Abel turned to comfort her. He told her that Margaret knew what she was doing and to go and do as Margaret said. Janice subsided, muttering lips and fingers among the children, who were bearing their secret compressed almost to eruption. Margaret had taken a small mirror from her handbag and was reassuring herself that her hair and makeup were perfect. She looked at the children.
Matthew, your tie is crooked. Ellen, you have a smudge. No, now it's fine.
It was so hard to talk to her, Abel thought. She was always so busy with plans. Sometimes it seemed to him that she put the plans in front of her to keep him away. The plans were like the way she wore her clothes, like an armor. He remembered Marshall saying something like it once, but the words had long gone. They were only a puzzle anyway, meaning without meaning. He turned and said to Janice, "Do you remember how we all used to come here with the cart and we took the pieces out this door?" Janice waved him away, so he touched Margaret on the arm and she had to turn her eyes from the little mirror and the perfect hair. "Do you remember how we all used to come?" Margaret looked down at her hands.
"Yes," she said, "but it seemed so much smaller. The way I remembered it, it was as big as a whole city block."
Then she looked away again. She had driven so as not to come past the streets of the old neighborhood, and she hoped that no one would think to ask her where they had lived or to take them past it. Then she shook it all away and said,
"It's time."
And they all got out of the car. Janice, defeated and hopeless, offered no resistance, but let herself be led in through the main floor and past the new reception desk. It had replaced the old line of cages which Margaret remembered and had steeled herself against seeing. A secretary caught her eye.
"Are you the family, Ryder?"
"Mrs. Ryder, yes."
"It's the second floor. Go right up. I'll buzz them and let them know you're here."
They went up in a little elevator, and a man met them as they got off. He was smiling and perspiring, busy even as he stood there, eyes darting, fingers plucking and smoothing his clothes or the air.
"Come! This way!"
he shouted because they were deaf. Margaret flinched. They went down the corridor to a set of double doors. This had once been part of the mill side of the plant, and Janice didn't know what it was used for now. She worked on the other side and had automatically turned down the corridor to go the other way before she had been guided back by the unhappy man. The doors were opened. She thought she heard machines. There were vibrations as of many machines. But then she stepped into the room and saw all the people, a whole roomful sitting at long tables and turned toward her, their mouths still, and no machines. Their hands were blurred with motion. Quickly, Janice turned away to hide the sign, "What is it?" to Margaret.
"It's an honor for you."
"Not a trial?"
"A party."
As Janice stood between doubt and comprehension, a series of flaming white explosions were hurled into her face. She cowered back, unable to see, afraid that they had set her on fire. Abel held her while the murderous white darkness blinded her from this side and that. He was trying to spell into her hand, "Photograph," but she clutched at him, too frightened to read his word. When the blinding was over, they led her dizzily past a large board from which, blown up to nearly life-size, a familiar dead stranger, trapped in a ridiculous dress, was staring back at her. In large letters it said, 1918 to 1963. Janice was introduced to the president at a raised table, and then someone else spoke for a minute or two while they all stood still. Then everyone sat down and began to eat. Janice struggled with the food. There were too many people, too much movement of hands, fingers, faces, so that she found herself distracted and couldn't turn her face to her food. She kept up a restless survey of the room, lest some signal be given which she should not miss or the explosions come again, which they did, from here and there during the meal. It seemed odd that everyone should stop work on an anniversary day and crowd into a room to blind her, and then watch her shake hands with the president while red dots from the blinding pulsed all over him, and then sit down and watch her drop crumbs on her front for half an hour. When the dishes were cleared away, a man came up to the table and sat next to her. There were to be speeches, he said,
and he had been called in to interpret. Janice made tiny signs in her lap.
In front of all these people?
They will be saying things about you to honor you, and you will want to thank them.
I don't want to. I am too embarrassed.
I'll be very quiet. No one will notice.
He was a young man, and he looked at her with gentle, deaf eyes. She decided to do him the favor. Are you from the deaf school?
Yes, I teach there.
How do you know sign? You speak like an educated person.
My parents were deaf.
And they taught you to sign like that?
Yes.
When we were young, she said, it was a shame to sign. Are they teaching children better now because the world is so modern?
Nothing has changed, he said. Nothing has changed for the deaf since long before you were born. A few schools, a few lucky ones. For the rest, no difference.
But everyone says that the world is so modern.
It only looks modern, and only to the people who aren't somehow between.
I am a very ignorant person, she said. I don't know how to speak like you do.
Nuts.
It was a wide, local hand, and she had seen it in church from some of the young people.
They both laughed.
There were introductions. People introduced others who introduced still others, and they all praised Janice and themselves to each other. Sometimes the interpreter explained when a little joke was made, so that she could laugh along with everyone, and she was grateful for this. Now and then she would look past the strangers and toward the end of the table, where Margaret was sitting straight and motionless, her eyes brushing the children for crumbs. Next to her was Abel, kept from the words. Never until this moment had Janice seen how embarrassed Margaret was at her deafness and Abel's. How was it that this young man beside her could be so different, so free and joyful in his sign? The speaker was talking about the old days and the hard conditions, all long changed. All so long changed, which the old-timers could still remember.
Perhaps through her interpreter, he was saying, our anniversary girl will share with us her memories of those old times.
It came to her that the man himself did not know that he was going to say this thing, that it had come to him in his own fear or good feeling after the long lunch and the other people talking. She did not want to say anything, and for long moments she and the young man stood up together locked in the light, while from the front and side the white explosions flashed and left blacker holes in the burnt-out daytime. The young man was trying hard to help her, and time was going by, and the faces of the whole world waited and readied their displeasure. You must remember some little thing that happened when you first went to work, he said. Her mind was without a picture. She felt as though she was going to die.
Anything? Do you remember the hours that you worked? Your wages when you started?
Oh, yes, she said, and told him, hating her hands, and he told the faces.
I made $14 a week, she says, before the bonus. While he said this to the people, she stole a cautious look at them. All the table faces turned toward her.
They were interested and approving.
We worked from 8 in the morning to 7 at night, she told them. And if the machine got your finger, you didn't get any sick leave. The people were smiling as the boy said these things. Their heads and hands and bodies were still, but leaning slightly forward, as people do who are interested. As she looked at them, she knew that they were not her enemies. And then she knew exactly what she wanted to say. It was this moment that they had given her, this moment that she deserved for her 45 years of work, and they were waiting to hear it, not with impatience, but with pleasure. As sharers. Her hands made the words more surely, and with a dignity she did not know she possessed. In her mind there was no conflicting picture, nothing else to think of but the words she was making and the gratitude she felt that she had been privileged to ascend to this day.
I did pieces. 9 or 10 years I did pieces before the union stopped it. I don't know why the union stopped the pieces, but I do not hate them anymore. And I am not angry at them now. Now I want to tell the unions and everybody, all the people here, that I never stole food, anyone's food,
and that my husband and children never stole anyone's lunch or his food ever."
The interpreter had stopped, his hands frozen at the end of a sign. His face had a hurt look. He said to her quickly, "I don't think this is clear. Can you explain it a little?"
She smiled at him and nodded yes. It must seem long ago to such a young person. Margaret was only a little girl when the pieces stopped. She went on. "The strike people said we were stealing. It had to do with the pieces."
The young man looked at her hopelessly while he spoke to them and managed an almost invisible shake of the head.
"You see, I had to do pieces because I had two children and I couldn't leave them. But I never stole or took food from any child. I never stole from any child or anybody. It was around 1930. My daughter there and my husband, they remember it. It was a long time ago. But some people might remember the bad things those unions said and think those things were true. And I thank you to give me the chance to say no, I did not take bread from anyone, and to tell my innocence." And then she sat down. Afterward, they gave her a plaque and a corsage, and she shook hands again with the president and others and talked some more with the young man. Looking around, she could tell that her words had been needed, because they all looked tired. Margaret was very pale, and Abel, too. Even the young interpreter had a wandering, glassy look to his eyes, such as people get when they have studied a thing as deeply as it can be studied. She realized that she, too, was tired, but there was one thing more. She said to them, "I want to show you my little room, and also the workroom that was where I used to be, and also where the raised place was where I was supervisor." The young man said he was expected back at the school, so she shook his hand for goodbye. It embarrassed her to find that she had been sweating. Her hand was sticky, and she could smell herself faintly but unmistakably over the cool blue smell of the corsage. Perhaps that was why they gave corsages. "Come on," she said to the others. She used the sign widely, eagerly. She was no longer afraid of being laughed at because of sign. Her years had also entitled her to the language, and she had not been ridiculed. She took the grandchildren by the hands and led them back to the corridor and then down the hall to the right. Margaret and Abel were following more slowly, and she began to wish they would hurry. Never had she imagined that she would be so eager to show anyone where all the years had been sewn up and sent away. She began to walk quickly, by habit and not with her eyes. The smell of cloth and lint and machine oil, and very slightly, of the burning of metal in friction. There was also the smell of the age of the floors and of floor cleaner, and still of sweat and many people. "Come on," she said, turning to hurry them. They moved a little faster. When she got to the large double doors that opened onto the workroom, she found that they were locked. She tried to push through them almost desperately, but they would not move open as they always had. Surely all the years should have given them that habit, surely now when it was so needed. But the doors did not move. She had to turn and tell them, "It's closed. Maybe some girls didn't know." She was, for some reason she did not understand, suddenly close to tears. "Well, come on and see this side, my place, my room. It has no door. It is against the wall on the other side. You have to turn this corner. My table is there where I can examine the things they bring me, and where you go in, it has my sign, Assistant Director of Quality Control." She turned the corner and stood very still while they all came up and looked and waited, their eyes gliding across the place and then away. The little room, the table and chair, the sign. They must have been taken away, all of them, because there was nothing there, only the wall. On the wall were two thin bands a shade lighter than the rest to show where the office of the Assistant Director of Quality Control had been. 21. Abel was sitting in a corner of the porch with the sun's redness captive under his closed lids. It was warm for June, and although it was only 10 in the morning, the heat was making him groggy. Janice had argued against his going outside while he still had symptoms and had been so sick. And every few minutes she came out and poked him up to watch her glower, or went stamping across the porch making the floor communicate. Abel heard and was comforted. Janice, in despair, had been a stranger too frightening to remember. Janice angry was only Janice. He hoped that Margaret's visit would not bring back any of the frightening part. Janice, dead-faced and shut against their signs, staring through windows as though they were walls, and at walls as though they were windows. Margaret had been over almost every day until Abel's slight stroke had brought Janice back to herself to nurse him. Now that he was recovering, he hoped it would not leave her with nothing to do. He had forgotten how often anger had saved Janice in the past. She was too frugal to waste so valuable a thing. Margaret was also thinking of Janice and her anger, and this morning she dreaded it more than ever. She guessed that the bitterness would not fall on Marshall but on herself, and though she had tried to keep the fact of her growing vulnerability a secret, her fingers jumped a little as she arranged her hat, and she caught a nail, snagged and broke it against the cloth of her white glove as she put it on. She had taken longer to dress than usual, checking and rechecking the angle of her hat and the condition of her bag, gloves, and shoes. If there was to be a battle, she wanted to present herself as invulnerable. Pearl necklace, one strand, matching earrings, full armor. As she drove to the old house, she was bothered again by how much the neighborhood had gone down. 10 years ago, no one had divided the big old houses into apartments or had signs in the windows for transient rooms. Occasionally, there might be a very small, genteel notice of piano lessons or alterations, apologetic whispered calls from hard-pressed widows or spinster ladies. Now the neighborhood was filling as people crowded into the apartments of the divided buildings, and the cries of out-of-work men were louder. Welding all kinds, in a sign 3 feet high in front of one porch. Knives and scissors sharpened, mower blades, cutters, in front of another. "We fix it," down the block, and a dozen for-rent and room-to-let signs between. The trees still reached over the street, large, rich, and leafy, but the houses beneath them had lost the ample, settled look they had once had. In front gardens and on lawns lay dead and brown, the weeds of last season catching at ragged bits of paper that had blown and come to rest there. Shortcuts crisscrossed the grounds. Here and there, a kind of fierce determination seized some two or three houses together. Neighboring ones would be painted in harsh, fresh color, the lawns and flower beds laid out straight as the laws of science, the porches gleaming and bare of furniture. One felt the rage in it all, and a beginning of hopelessness. It made the unkempt houses look that much worse. The block on which Janice and Abel lived had been no more than brushed as yet, but Margaret could see it was only a matter of time. She sighed. With everything that was happening, she didn't know if she had the energy to look around for some new houses to argue and harangue and cajole over. She pulled up to the curb, turned off the motor, and went through the unconscious series of checkings and straightenings that were now habitual with her. She patted her hat, smoothed her hair, her hands moving down to brush and smooth her clothes as her face erased from its surface any sign of emotion. As she got out of the car, she looked up and saw Abel sunning on the porch. The front door opened, and Janice came out, saw her, and stopped for a moment to adjust her own face. Margaret took a deep breath and went purposefully up the walk. "Did you have a nice weekend?" "Yes, fine." She gained time by asking about it. Abel was moving his chair around so that he could see his daughter. There was tension moving thickly all around them. He remembered the children in the blind section of school who played their fingers over the faces of strangers.
"Dad, how were you over the weekend? You look a lot better today."
He gained time by telling her about it. Then, at last,
"Why didn't Marshall write?"
It was Janice, loudly, sloppily, and Margaret almost had to smile. What amazing instincts her mother had.
"I don't know, Mother. I told him what the company was going to do for you and that a telegram delivered to the mill would be nice. I suppose he got involved in something at school and it just slipped his mind."
"He has not written to us for a long time,"
Abel said. I missed the letters he sent at the beginning. He writes to you. What does he say?
He says he is fine. He mentions the work, his classes, and what he is taking up.
Then why doesn't he write to us? Why doesn't he talk to us also in those letters? Janice demanded. If he can't come and if he won't write to us.
The letter was in Margaret's purse, and her fingers rose over the clasp, waiting. And then she made a decision, opened the purse, and took out his letter.
Maybe she could read part of it. Maybe she could fix it and read some of it.
She opened the letter and skimmed it quickly. Dear Mother, I didn't write or send a telegram to Grandma because I couldn't have said anything that wouldn't have been hypocritical and dishonest. After exploiting her and denying her her human dignity for 50 years, they cooked up a cheap publicity stunt to advertise their own good works through her. I don't see how you could have allowed it to happen.
He says he's fine,
Margaret said. I got the clippings you sent from the Herald in that trade paper.
He got the clippers I sent, of the pictures. He says he was very glad to have them.
And I thought they were a real study.
He gave them a lot of study.
How horrified Grandma looks at being used like that. How marvelously she seems to rise above what they tried to do to her. They could give her that curly hair and pin that corsage on her, but she never could or would fit into any of it. How much more honest if she had gone there in a simple house dress and let them all know that, deaf or not, she knew what this society does to its misfits.
He says that was no work dress you were wearing.
I have definitely decided to go with We Shall Overcome this summer. Where exactly, we don't know, but it will be somewhere in the rural South and we will live in the poverty that this country imposes on so many.
He talks about his summer plans.
And with the letter lying in her lap, she noticed a slight stutter in her hands. Janice and Abel opened their words together. Each knew immediately that his own forgivable greed would be shaping itself in the other one's mind.
Where is he going for the summer? What does he plan to do?
He isn't sure, Margaret lied, wondering where her gifts had gone. Years of dissembling for oneself came to weakness and stuttering when it was needed most, in defense of someone loved more than oneself. There is a group of young people at the university, a group which is interest.
The sign made no distinction between interested and interesting, and there she hid gratefully in the cleft of the difference. She needed the moment's cover and a chance to peer out at the pursuers.
William and I know that he must work very closely with the people at the university while he is there.
Up again and gone. But Janice and Abel were not to be outrun. They came on paced with the slow, inexorable logic of their need. She must write to him and tell him to spend the holiday with them. If he had friends, he could leave them for a while. He had not been to the house since he had left for college. He had heard almost nothing of his grandmother's honor day. He had forgotten all his sign, but they would write things to him. At least they could see him, and now that his grandfather was going to retire, there would be time to share all of the things they had promised themselves. There would be time for him to learn sign again, to help them as that wonderful young man had helped Janice.
I know he would be glad to hear from you, Margaret said, beating backward toward another hiding place.
Then she saw that their eyes had moved from her. There was a woman coming up the walk, a quick woman, moving in a businesslike way but with small gestures of unease. She had tried to dress well, but something was missing and she looked uncomfortable in the clothes. She was holding a paper of some sort, selling something, Margaret thought, or trying to. The parents sat still, deferring to her as they always did. Margaret would send the person away without the need for embarrassment. They settled back, their faces deadened. When they looked again, however, the woman was still there, and in another moment, Margaret was speaking to them. At her side, the woman stood, braced, trying not to stare.
This is a neighbor of yours, Margaret said hastily. Her sign stubbed and small and a little angry, because she was conscious of having done this for so many years without having lost the sense of shame. She has a petition for you to sign.
Together, their lips formed the word petition, and then Abel turned to Janice and explained it.
There's a house on the next block that's up for sale, and there's a certain group that is trying to buy it.
The woman spoke to Margaret and she mumbled, being ashamed to use her voice. Margaret took her words dutifully.
The group is a group of drug addicts.
Addict. Drug. It had first come out as people who use too much medicine, and so Margaret had to explain again and then to explain drug addiction. She had begun to perspire heavily now. Beneath its makeup, she felt her skin melting in the heat. Abel suddenly came alight.
Oh, yes, I know what it is. He made a quick sign to show her, but the sign was new. The young people call it this. The minister at church was telling us about it. Also, and he spelled, A-C-I-D-H-E-A-D.
Acid head. The neighbor was beginning to feel beyond her depth and the heat was beginning to glaze her eyes. Margaret saw her glance quickly to the house, no doubt longing for the dark, cool recesses of the rooms inside. But then her face closed and she pulled her eyes away, because she did not wish to incur any small debt to these people. Margaret fought back the desire to ask her in, and so forced the refusal from her. But Janice and Abel were both talking together, upset and frightened.
Now, are these dopers going to get a house?
They have to be in jail.
Yes, what about putting them in jail? Janice cried. Dope is against the law, and if they have it and people know, they will call the police and the dopers will have to go to jail.
Even before Margaret was finished giving the words, the woman was ready.
The police can't be there all the time. These people call themselves recovered addicts, and they say they need a rehabilitation center for others. They call it a halfway house.
Halfway to what is what I would like to know.
Our streets will be full of dope fiends and police. People won't be able to go out at night. Those people will get to know who goes in and who goes out and what women are left alone nights. Every one of these people has just come out of jail. You know the kind of people they are, a criminal element, the lowest kind of criminals, people who are diseased.
Margaret translated dutifully, but it came flat against the echo of the woman's long-drawn, venomous whisper. It sounded ridiculous as she framed it in her fingers, the woman's hysterical picture of the streets overflowing with crime, a dope fiend hiding in wait behind every tree. She would have Janice and Abel sign the petition, of course, but not for this woman's reasons. They were all looking toward Margaret now, Janice and Abel waiting for her to give them the undermeanings of the hearing, the difference, that unbridgeable difference. She excused herself to the neighbor who lapsed, melting and staring into her own mind, and addressed herself to the two old people.
I'm not afraid for your safety, she said slowly. But if we let these people come in, it will mean that the neighborhood has given up.
I don't understand, Abel said.
It has to do with losing something, with having something that makes your life worth living and then losing it. Has that ever happened to you?
Janice and Abel looked at each other with what Margaret could have sworn was guilt.
Yes, Abel said. It happened once.
Well, Margaret went on. If the neighborhood gives up and lets these people in, poverty